The Bloody Podcassacre with Zach Walters and Kennedy Catherine.
The worst kind of ASMR.
Oh my god, speaking of ASMR, I am obsessed with it right now. I am on such a binge.
Oh, listen. I listen to a lot of ASMR while I'm at work. Like, just like a lot of like the guided meditation type of stuff when I'm stressed. And there was this period of time where our graphic designer's AirPods were constantly connecting to my computer so many times. I would just catch his eye as my headphones cut out and I could tell someone else is cut in and he would just be like, why is someone whispering to you? And I'd be like, Ruben, it's not for you to worry about and it's none of your business, quite frankly.
But you should enjoy it. You're welcome.
So who are you into? What are you into for ASMR?
I don't know if they're like words or sounds that people use specifically when they do ASMR, but I know that there's some that I like and there's some that I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Like when they go like, I'm like, that's fine. There's one with like an S and a K. It's like, and I'm like, no,
oh,
I'm like,
please that, stop. No, that hurt my bones.
Don't like it. I also really like hand movements, just in general.
Me too. In a non-sexual way, I like watching massage videos. A, I would love to be in that position.
Yeah. It's nice because you know that those people are relaxed. It makes you feel relaxed. And you're just like, yes. The ASMR world is so, it's massive.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's some where people like are just soft-spoken. There's some like that are whispering. I like soft spoken now more. Whispering can kind of get off on my nerves sometimes. There's this one and this woman does like Reiki ASMR. I don't know how much I believe in like Reiki as a form of medical practice, but it's like a spiritual practice.
Yeah, for sure.
And she does this one where she like pulls like negative energy from you. Like,
I love that
energy
one.
Pulling. But she has these two metal rings and she like slowly just like puts her fingers together like scissors and cuts them. But then her rings clink together and like the softest, like, nicest way. Oh, thank you. Whispers of the Wild or whatever her name is. I can't remember.
Delightful.
And she always starts to fit in. She's like, hi, love. And I'm like, hello. It's just like, so nice.
I have an ASMR video on YouTube.
Do you know?
I do. I don't know if it still exists. I have to imagine it does because I do not remember ever going back and getting rid of it. So embarrassing. I was really into it for a long time. People would pop off when they got into ASMR. And I was like, I could fucking do that. I have a nice voice.
I know.
No.
I feel like
not.
I could never.
It's embarrassing. It is inherently performative. And like, there's something about it that is very intimate.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels like something that other people shouldn't have to listen to.
I couldn't imagine like having a roommate who does ASMR. Could you imagine me like, you have to be quiet for like an hour. And you're like, stop.
Hey, guys, just really want you to fall asleep tonight. And just a roommate's like, can I just watch some fucking Real Housewives, bitch? Right? Like, shut up.
Oh, no.
Anyway.
ASMR. Love it. Complete side note. Someone died outside of my apartment the other day.
You really said, let's turn the ship around 180. Relaxation to death.
Yes. Very unfortunate.
It is really sad.
It was a homicide. I came home from the grocery store after work and there was about 20 cop vehicles. The like guns and gang squad was out.
That's scary.
They were walking around. I was on the phone with a friend who is a listener of the podcast. And he was like, oh my gosh, like, tell me what happened. Like, this is so crazy. So I was explaining to him like that all the stuff I saw is in the cop vehicles. I didn't see any of the actual crime.
Yeah.
And as I was talking, like, I got a knock on my door, and I was like, this is it. And I was like, I bet it's major crimes. And it was. They came and said, hello, do you know anything? And I said, no.
So how does that work? Step by step, they just come. Do they ask you who you are? Do they say, this is what happened?
No. So they don't really, like, release anything, because I don't think they want people to, one, be scared, to start maybe wanting to provide false statements, you know? Be that person, be like, oh, well, I heard this happen, you know, like that. They were just like, are you aware that there was an incident around here? And I was like, I figured I saw the press release because my coworker sent it to me. And I said I was not home during the time frame and I just saw the aftermath of just like cops. And they're like, okay, like, is there anyone else in your apartment? I was like, nope.
That was that.
And that was that. And they left. So
interesting.
I also know from work to never be a witness.
I know from life.
I think we've talked about this. It's just like, it's a hard thing for a lot of people to do.
I never know how to explain it. I will say it was something that gave me an understanding of the legal system that I wouldn't have otherwise. Mm-hmm. And when you have highly publicized trials, I am grateful for that foundation of having had the experience of being a witness in a trial, because I understand the inner workings of it in a way that, like, things are so sensationalized and people are made out to, like, yeah, look a certain way. And I just know, like, oh no, that's just how you have to behave, or like, those are the questions they have to ask you. Mm-hmm. It's such a ridiculous fucking position to be in, because they have to ask you these questions that feel so asinine and silly. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't wish it on anyone if you could avoid it. It's very stressful, and it's kind of, I mean, I'm sure it would depend on the context. I was in a position of having to talk about a former relationship, and I had to, like, disclose intimate details, and that was really hard, because mm-hmm. I had, like, my sexuality and, like, my person sort of taken into question, even though the trial, to be clear, had nothing to do with me. And so that was difficult.
Were you a character witness, kind of?
No.
Oh.
Like a circumstantial, like, situational witness. I just felt sort of, like, dehumanized, I guess. I don't think that would be everyone's experience. Mm-hmm. It was very dependent on the circumstances of this case.
That's, like, also, it's very interesting, because before I went into my current job, mm-hmm. I was very set on wanting to be on, like, a jury duty, mm-hmm. like, as a jury member, because everybody thinks it's, like, wow, you get to do all this cool stuff, like, you get to listen. The crazy thing is that with jury duty, you can't talk to anybody else about it. You can't talk about the details. You can't go to therapy for it. Like, I mean, people will talk. Like, it's bound to happen. But, like, you can see and hear things that you will never be able to unhear or talk to anybody outside of those other, however many jury members there are. And so take that into consideration.
Because it can be deeply traumatizing.
Yeah, like, especially if you're looking at images, videos. It could be children, it could be adults, anything. Mm-hmm. You don't know what it's going to be like until you actually see it.
Yeah.
And you're hearing, like, firsthand encounters of people who've been affected by that, and that is also very hard.
Mm-hmm. Strangely, when I was a witness, you have no fucking idea what's going on. You literally walk in blind. I had no idea what I was going to be asked. They don't prepare you. You have no idea what the procedure of it is. I didn't even know where I was supposed to stand. Like, I walked in and I was so confused. I found the jury to be kind of comforting. It was pretty cut and dry who the guilty party was. Mm. And so I think they were sort of, I was a sympathetic figure to them. I think they understood, like, this person doesn't want to be here. I found, like, looking at them and having particularly, like, the women who were there look back at me, I felt very comforted by their mm-hmm. presence, because I was like, you know what? At the end of the day, you don't want to fucking be here either. You don't want to have to make this call.
I know. Isn't it so crazy that as, like, a system, we say we are giving the power to these 12 random people
mm-hmm.
and they have no connection to you and they are going to judge you.
Yeah. Based on
storytelling.
Oh, yeah. It's wild. And you look at cases like the highly publicized Depp v. Heard trial that's happening right now.
It ended today. The jury went into deliberation.
It did. I have very complex feelings about it.
It's a lot. It is a lot. It's so crazy also because it's been 6 weeks plus, because it's been in the media.
Trials don't take that long.
No. Well, yeah, they do.
They do sometimes.
It depends on the case. But like, for a defamation trial, absolutely not.
No. And I'm not making any statements about how I feel or whatever, but it's a real sobering reality check when you watch something like this happen and you realize it comes down to being a charismatic person.
Mm-hmm.
Because in court, you have people who could be extremely knowledgeable witnesses or experts. But if you don't know how to publicly speak well,
yeah,
people are not going to identify with you. You could be somebody who's totally making shit up. I'm not talking about Johnny Depp or Amber Heard. Like, I could, it's none of my business. Just in a general sense, somebody could be totally equipped but not a good public speaker, and then someone who has, like, no fucking idea but just happens to be very charming and charismatic could completely sway a jury. And mm-hmm. that is so unsettling.
It's very interesting also because where we are, you can elect to be judge alone or by judge and jury.
Mm-hmm.
And people who pick jury, I'm like, oh my God. Anyways.
I mean,
I could go on for a long time.
The movie we're covering today, at least, is slightly procedural, so we're not completely off track.
True. I do have two horror things. One relates to this movie that we're about to talk about, slightly. Okay. The first one is, I thought there was a trailer, but there's not. There is a new movie. I don't know if it's coming out soon. I'm assuming it's in post-production. It is based on some beloved characters that majority of us grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. Not related to Disney, but earlier this year in January, Winnie the Pooh was added into public domain mm-hmm. because it is a very old character. Now that it's in public domain, we could have Winnie the Pooh as our mascot because it is free for anyone and everyone to use.
Crazy.
Isn't that wild?
That is.
The other thing is that True Detective, have you ever watched that show?
No, I haven't.
So it's coming back for a fourth season, and Jodie Foster is our main actress.
Really? That's so interesting.
So it's called True Detective Night Country, which is the title for season four. And Issa Lopez, who wrote Tigers Are Not Afraid, which I think it was a horror movie that came out either last year or the year before.
Okay.
A lot of people loved it. It was a foreign film. Is on board to write the season. So it follows Jodie Foster as Detective Liz Danvers and Evangeline Navarro, who is another detective, trying to solve the case of six men that operate the Sala Arctic Research Station, who vanished without a trace in the long winter night in Ennis, Alaska.
That sounds good.
I know that one thing, like, apparently True Detective Season 1, like, knocked everything out of the park.
I know.
And then it's depleted.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who loved Season 1. I couldn't even tell you anything about.
I don't know anything. I know, like, I could be like, okay.
Woody Harrelson?
I want to say it was in Season 2.
Oh, okay.
I honestly couldn't tell you.
Oh, it was comedian. He's not a comedian, but comedic wedding crashers. What is his name? Tall.
Yeah.
Dark hair. Ugh, this is going to kill me. Okay, first season was Matthew McConaughey, Woody Harrelson, mm-hmm. Michelle Monaghan, big fan. And then
Season 2 was Colin Farrell, Rachel McAdams, Taylor Kitsch.
Why did I think Vince Vaughn was in it?
In Season 2.
Okay.
And that's then who season I was three of. Was Marshala Ali, Stephen Dorff, Carmen Eyogo.
Not sure.
Ray Fisher. I also thought that she used to be in that movie, Sky High. Do you remember that movie?
I do.
She was the villain. She was also in the 10 Cloverfield Lane. Anyways, so Jodie Foster. Gonna be back on our televisions very soon.
Love to see it. This might sound like a criticism, but I don't necessarily mean it that way. She is very good at playing sort of like one note. Yep. She is the type of person who I feel like plays a very good collected emotional person rather than a demonstrative emotional person. So like a detective and somebody who has to sort of like keep their emotions at a low, low boil at all times mm-hmm. is a good fit for her.
Yeah. And like even like she's a character that had to like, I don't know, always like have to figure out something.
Well, because Jodie Foster is very intelligent and mm-hmm. I feel like she feels very intelligent.
I'm trying to think of other movies she's in other Nims than Island. Panic Room. I'm having war flashbacks.
Yeah, dude.
I forgot that was a movie.
Sure was.
I have a specific memory being very, very ill with the flu as a child.
Oh, no.
Watching that movie. And it was like a fever dream because I literally was having a fever.
I remember it being pretty cute. I've only seen it once.
Anyways, Nims Island. Contact.
Taxi Driver. Her first movie when she was 13.
I don't think I've ever seen it.
It's good. It's old, obviously.
Anyways, the movie we were talking about, though, today.
Silence of the Lambs, 1993, I think.
91.
91.
This was the first time that I have ever seen this movie.
Yes. Initial, just right off the top, just give us like a quick, like, few word summary about how you felt.
Because I have no idea. Wait. Before we get into that, Jodie Foster, she was in The Mortarian. Exact same character. She is a lawyer.
Mm.
But that's the one where I have the book. It's the man was held captive in Guantanamo Bay for X amount of years, was never formally charged with anything. But anyways, Jodie Foster, Shailene Woodley, Benedict Cumberbatch, Zachary Levi.
Benedict Cumberbatch has the most punchable face.
I know.
Loathe him.
Anyways, oh my god, Flight Plan.
Great movie. She feels like she would play a great... Never mind. It's So stupid. I just almost said she feels like she would play a great mom to Kristen Stewart.
Because you know what's crazy is I was like, when I watched this movie, I was like, wow, she looks like a young Kristen Stewart.
They don't actually look all that similar, but there's a very similar feeling to their expression and the way that they emote.
Yes.
And not the way they sound necessarily, but the way they say things is very similar.
Like, I was like, if they ever were to remake this movie, Kristen Stewart.
Maybe.
Yes. Besides the point. My first reactions. The only thing that I knew was, like, kind of the memes, the photos. I honestly did not really know what the story was about.
Yeah.
I had this expectation that it was following him actually eating people, Hannibal Lecter, because I had the idea of the 2013 show with Mads Mikkelsen in mind. And I've only seen a couple episodes of that, never really fell into it. However, I was very shocked that it was more of like a thriller. It really is like a psychological thriller, less horror, but the horror elements are within the storytelling.
Absolutely.
And some visuals. There are some visual moments where you're like, like, not a fan of that. But it really, I text you, it felt like a prolonged episode of 2020 to me, because it's kind of just holding that storyline where it's constantly trying to figure out the next move. What's happening? It's who is this?
Very
it's
a whodunit.
Yeah. But the thing is that this was kind of that first movie that did a lot of those tropes that we know now, even in like 2020 storytelling, leaving like you on a cliffhanger with a character and like going into another one and then like talking back and then bringing it back and looping it all together. I did enjoy it a lot, just was not what I was expecting.
Yeah.
And I can see why this movie is so like highly acclaimed, because it's like, I feel like every little detail of this movie is so well thought out. And like, you can tell that the like people put the time into the characters, into the story, into the sets, and like, it is a very well-rounded movie overall.
Yeah, I feel as if there is not like a single wasted shot or line. It's a very intelligently put together movie. Mm-hmm. I do feel like a common misconception for audiences who did not grow up with this movie is that it will be very Hannibal Lecter-centric, because Hannibal is such a renowned character. Yeah. And we know that this is sort of the quote-unquote origin, even though it's not, actually. You are not the first person to sort of be misled about what the story actually is. Mm-hmm. And the story is more so about Clarice and this relationship with Hannibal, with a secondary storyline that is Buffalo Bill.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I read, which I didn't really think about until later, is so we have Hannibal Lecter, who Clarice is talking to, but Clarice in this story is trying to track another serial killer through the mind of Hannibal Lecter named Buffalo Bill. And someone put very simply that Hannibal is her intellectual antagonist and Buffalo Bill is her physical antagonist. And I was like, that is a very good analogy for it, because she's just trying to track him down, but she has two kind of like roadblocks.
I think she kind of has multiple antagonists in this movie.
Right.
It's sort of, I didn't pick up on a lot of this when I was younger, obviously. Watching it through a lens of an adult woman now, she was really just sort of the Little Red Riding Hood of it all. Like, she was constantly put into situations by men or in situations with men where she was belittled or made to be lesser than or sort of preemptively victimized. And it is kind of a story of her triumph.
And it's crazy because, like, a lot of the movie while we're watching it is through the eyes of the male gaze.
Mm.
And, like, you feel for her the whole time.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, even not, like, identifying as a woman, it's like you can see still so many characteristics of just, like, I don't know, media portrayals, like, now.
Well, I also think, like, it's easy to identify your own vulnerabilities in a person who, they do a really good job of balancing sort of her professionalism with her personal vulnerability. And so you can see yourself in that easily.
And one thing that I also saw online that I like really liked is that it's kind of one of the few films where the female protagonist arc is not shaped, defined, or influenced by any romantic entanglement but her own path from child to woman.
Ooh.
And I was like, yes.
Yes.
Correct.
I know that that was a really attractive thing to Jodie Foster about this movie, which I think we can probably get into after we break it down.
Should we get into the little storyline?
Let's do it. Okay, so though the really important pivotal main characters in this movie are few, it is a movie with a lot of moving parts. So this is once again a pretty bare bones retelling of the movie, but you will get everything you need to get for our conversation about it. So Clarice Starling, Jodie Foster, is pulled from her FBI training at the FBI Academy by Jack Crawford of the Bureau's Behavioral Science Unit. He assigns her to interview Hannibal Lecter, a former psychiatrist and incarcerated cannibalistic serial killer. Good combination. Crawford believes Lecter's insight could prove useful in the pursuit of a serial killer nicknamed Buffalo Bill, who kills young women and removes the skin from their bodies. Although initially pleasant and courteous, Lecter grows impatient with Starling's interviewing. As she's leaving, a prisoner named Miggs flicks semen at her. Lecter, who considers this an unspeakably ugly act, calls Starling back and tells her to seek out his old patient. This leads her to a storage facility where she discovers a jar containing a man's severed head. She returns to Lecter, who says the man is linked to Buffalo Bill. He offers to profile Buffalo Bill on the condition that he be transferred to another institution. In the meantime, Buffalo Bill abducts Catherine Martin, the daughter of a United States senator. Clarice is authorized to offer Hannibal a fake deal, promising a transfer if he provides information that helps them capture their killer. Instead, Lecter demands to offer clues in exchange for personal information. Clarice tells him about her father's murder. The prison secretly records the conversation and reveals the fake deal to Hannibal before offering him a different one. He agrees and is flown to Memphis, where he meets and torments Senator Martin, giving her false information about Buffalo Bill. Clarice visits Hannibal, now imprisoned in a Tennessee courthouse, and requests the truth. He says all the information she needs is contained in the Buffalo Bill case file. He returns the case files and later that evening kills his guards, escapes from his cell, and disappears. Clarice analyzes the files and realizes Buffalo Bill knew his first victim. She visits the victim's home and notices dress patterns identical to the patches of skin removed from the victims. Buffalo Bill is making a suit with human skin. The FBI team is already en route to arrest a man who believes he is transsexual but was deemed too insane to apply for gender reassignment. No, that is a word that was used at the time. But the FBI finds the house empty. Meanwhile, Clarice interviews another person who knew the victim. At the house, she meets Jack Gordon, who she realizes is their suspect. She pursues him into a cavernous basement and finds Catherine trapped in a dry well. When he attempts to shoot Clarice, she beats him to it. Catherine is freed, and Buffalo Bill is dead. At the FBI Academy graduation party, she receives a phone call from Hannibal, who is at an airport. He assures her that he has no intention of pursuing her and requests that she returns the favor. He subsequently hangs up the phone because he is, quote, having an old friend for dinner. And that is Silence of the Lambs.
Wow.
An iconic movie, truly, actually.
It really is. I think that my favorite part of this movie for me was the last 18 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like, even the last half an hour, it's just, like, nonstop, like, intensity, because you have the whole situation of Clarice being right and, like, figuring out the case on her own, and the FBI, like, completely, like,
undermining
her. Yes, and being on the wrong side and being, like, at the wrong house, and you're like, oh, my God. And it's just, like, it builds up to so much. It feels so strange knocking? Who am I knocking? Not talking about, like, the horror elements of it being my favorite part.
But I feel like the horror in this, and we kind of had a text exchange about this, but, like, the horror in this now is very subtle.
Yes.
And so the things that stick out to you the most are sort of the character triumph and the intelligent aspects of this movie.
Yeah. Like, one thing is, like constantly, like, one of the horrifying things beside Hannibal being Hannibal the cannibal is, like, him trying to, like, constantly, like, leverage every, like, scenario possible so that it fits him. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, he's just, like, 100% a psychopath.
Yeah.
And it's, like, that's horrifying.
It is. Because
there are people like there who are not necessarily cannibals, but also out there just being psychopaths and leveraging everything to their own position and making everybody else indispensable.
And it's horrifying that Jack Crawford intentionally put her in this position.
Yes.
Because he knows that she's going to be the one to get results from him. And Hannibal kind of, for lack of a better term, gets off on getting to know people in this intimate mm-hmm. way to this depth. And she just has to play the game.
And, like, they do have some, like, because it, like, their whole relationship, like I said, is purely, like, intellectual.
And I think she benefits from it in a way. Mm-hmm. I think she, maybe she fiercely dislikes things about him, but I think there's an aspect of mutual respect there in some way.
Because Hannibal, you can tell, like, slowly gains this, like, respect for her because she can, like, keep up with his wits and his, like, what he's trying to do, and she can figure it out, where I feel like a lot of those other FBI agents haven't been able to, mm-hmm. or even doctors. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think that, for me, like, if he was to, like, get out in this movie and come for her, I don't think he would ever attack her.
No, as he says, the world is more interesting with you in it. I genuinely believe that. I feel like Hannibal, though he's not an admirable character, I'm not mm-hmm. trying to paint him in a positive light by any means, but he has standards.
Yeah.
He's not killing for the thrill of killing. He's not killing just to kill. He's discerning in what he chooses to do. And for him, she's not really that option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you feel about, I guess, like, their relationship? Like, I sort of had this feeling that for her, coming from, you know, small town West Virginia, not really having a developed circle of people, kind of growing up on her own, I have to wonder if she, like, felt seen or heard or delighted by someone who was, like, actually taking an active interest in her and also putting in the mental work to try to figure her out.
I think so. Because, like, even when you see the relationship between when they're having the conversation prior to her being assigned to the case with other FBI agents, it's like, oh, well, you're always so close, but you're never quite there. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, there's, like, that validation of finally being like, no, I deserve to be here. I don't know if they would, like, be friends.
No, I don't think so.
But, and not saying that she's a psychopath, but it feels like somebody that's, like, finally understands her, like, on a deep level. That's yeah. not just being, like, surface.
And, like, and validating, like, oh, well, her intellect. Because yeah. she realizes she's doing something that other people were incapable of doing. Mm-hmm.
And, like, in half the amount of time.
Yeah.
Good for her.
Good for her.
She's a real girl boss.
Gaslight.
Gatekeep girl boss. Mm. The three characters. Buffalo Bill, Clarice, and Hannibal.
Yeah.
Gaslight is totally Buffalo Bill.
And then gatekeep Hannibal.
Hannibal.
Girl boss,
Clarice.
There we go.
One thing that I know that I, like, said it's a very thriller movie, but I think that, like, a lot of new thriller movies could probably take away from this, is that there's so much, like, restraint and, like, power of restraint in this movie, and where that, like, less is more.
Mm.
And I wish that more movies were like this. Because even though it's not big theatrics, there's some points where, like, there is, like, running around and, like, whatever. What's the word I'm looking for?
Subtle. Like, and also yeah. their acting, you would think, just on a surface level, that, like, they're doing a lot. They're not doing much.
No.
And I also found that, like, part of an aspect that kept this movie so grounded in this way that you're talking about is that there was also very comedic elements.
Yes.
I loved, like, the little lines where he's like, love the suit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just little things like that where you're like, yeah, this feels, there's moments that just break this tension. And
well, it just makes it feel so natural.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't feel like I said, theatrical in, like, any sense where you're like, you can tell they're acting, they're being over the top. It's like, it's just like normal conversations, but, like, there's something about them that, like, adds it to the next level of it.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about, like, the Jonathan Demme sort of Hitchcockian way of having them play directly to camera?
I liked it. One thing that I did find out in research is that the only person who doesn't kind of play to camera is Clarice, and she's kind of always looking, like, off.
I think I've heard about this. Is it because it's always supposed to be her perspective? So, like, from her perspective, we are looking at the other characters head on,
mm-hmm.
but we're not going to see her head on.
So it said that it was done so that the audience would directly experience her point of view, but not theirs, hence encouraging the audience to more readily identify with her.
Mm-hmm.
So she's, yeah, always looking slightly off camera, which I think is a cool little thing, because then you're always like, why is everybody constantly staring at the camera?
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes you feel uneasy because you're like, did I do something wrong?
Mm-hmm. Well, an interesting thing that I heard about a recent, from a pretty recent interview with Jodie Foster, is she and Anthony Hopkins did not speak at all throughout the production.
Interesting.
And it wasn't a communicated choice by either one of them, but she said she was terrified of him.
I did read that she was terrified.
Because of this whole playing to camera thing, they were rarely having a conversation, actually. They're looking directly at the camera. The other one is somewhere behind the camera, mm-hmm. but they're not looking at each other. And she said on the very last day that they had a conversation where she finally, like, admitted to him, I'm sorry, it's just, like, I've been terrified of you. And he was like, I was terrified of you, which I just think is kind of sweet.
It's really funny because, so, one, like, little tidbit is that you think that Anthony Hopkins, he only is in 21% of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
He only has 24 minutes and 52 seconds of screen time, which also is the shortest performance for an Academy Award winner for Best Leading Role.
And this movie cleaned up.
Yeah, it was a full house sweep. The one thing is that they only share 4 scenes throughout the course of this movie together.
Which is wild, because, like, if you asked me about that and I just watched it, I would not think that's
true. I know, and that's, like, another thing where going into the movie, I thought it was going to be their dynamic relationship the whole time, because you have those iconic moments of, like, hello, Clarice. Mm. And I expected them to interact so much more, like, face-to-face. I also didn't expect him to be in jail for 90% of the movie.
What is that fucking cell thing that he is in? That is one part of this movie that is so deeply illogical.
Like, some people get metal bars, but he gets the glass?
Well, and also, like, at the end, when he gets transferred to Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
where are you even? I know they say it's the courthouse, but it looks like he's in a library or, like, a beautiful museum.
I don't know. They were like, you know what? Add some nice little theatrics behind. Mm-hmm. It'll be nice with that little mask.
Sorry, I just got lost in my own train of thought thinking about him. Just love it. I read a thing that was talking about how, so one of the most iconic lines is, like, and I ate him with some fava beans and a nice Chianti. Mm-hmm. And then he does the thing that I absolutely cannot do to save my life. I
couldn't try.
He improvised that. And Jonathan Demme, the director, did not like it and was, like, so sick of it. Probably because that was, like, so iconic and he didn't really care for it. But the Chianti is him making fun of her accent. It was not scripted that way. And I guess her feelings were, like, genuinely hurt.
No.
Yeah. Isn't that so sad afterwards?
Well, also, she was, being, like, terrified of him.
Yeah.
And then being, like, made fun of by him.
She said that there were many moments where she was very grateful for his performance because it gave her something tangible to actually work with, but that a lot of the times, like, it just felt hurtful.
Because you have to be like, thank you. And then going back to her being like,
yeah. Anthony Hopkins only hates my accent.
I wonder if, I know that I said they only shared four scenes together. I wonder if they had more, but it was cut.
I don't know.
It'd be interesting to know. Because
mm-hmm.
it's so strange that it's like they only had 4 scenes together, but they were so incredibly terrified of each other.
Well, maybe that's why. You know, if you're spending a really long time with someone, at some point you're going to get over it. But mm-hmm. because they probably had fairly minimal shoot time together, because when you think about it, she's heavily throughout the rest of the film mm-hmm. with a lot of different people, a lot of different scenes. So maybe that was confined to, like, 2 weeks that they spent together, and then she was off doing her own thing the rest of the time. Mm-hmm.
I feel like it probably was less. 2 weeks seems like a long
time. That is a long time.
Especially with him being in less than 30 minutes of the film.
Yeah, you're right. I guess it would depend how long the shoot was in mm-hmm. general.
And also, you know, how many takes they have to do. And I'm sure that they would laugh and, like, mess up like we do, because we're, you know,
we're just little funny jokester owls.
I'm having a hard time segueing in this movie.
It's all right. Just jump around.
Do you know mm-hmm. that Anthony Hopkins, when he got the call in London when he was working on something else, his agent told him that there was a script called Silence of the Lambs, and he thought he was going to be signing up for a children's movie. Could you imagine going into it and, like, being like, oh, this wonderful children's movie, getting the script and then reading it and being like, I'm eating people? Also, I think I'm stupid, but why is this movie called The Silence of the Lambs?
So when Clarice is explaining that she went to live with her, I believe it was her aunt and mm-hmm. husband, or, like, the cousin, she talks about how she ran away because there was this night where she went and all the lambs were screaming. They were on a farm, and she woke up in the middle of the, how do you not remember that? It's, like, one of the most iconic parts of the film. She's talking with Hannibal when they're in the courthouse in Tennessee. He's like, quid pro quo, like, you have to tell me things. And she's like, I was sleeping and I got up in the middle of the night and I went into the barn and all of these lambs were screaming and I tried to move one, but he was too heavy.
I do remember now.
Okay.
Once you said the courthouse, I was like,
Right.
Also, quid pro quo.
Yeah.
So often during the movie. At one point, I was like, take a shot. Every time.
Blackout. Scream fiasco, this bitch.
Should. We'd love to have a fiasco.
I have a lot of also really random notes, and one little, like, pet peeve that I have with it. Her conclusionary jumps, like, the way that she pieces mm-hmm. evidence together and, like, comes up with her sort of path to get where she goes, does feel a little, like, okay, like, at times.
You did that?
But then I also have to remember that there are people in this world who are much fucking smarter than me.
Also, like, people who can just, like, solve general puzzles without having to think about it.
And there's, like, pathologists and psychologists and people who actually do this shit, and I'm not one of them. No, so,
and she, you know, does training on probably, like, things like that.
Far be it from me to judge.
I would like to be that person.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Like, to go into escape rooms and, you know, not be like, oh, well, what if we shine the flashlight over here? And they're like, that's just a hole in the wall. That's not part of the game. And I'm like, yeah. Anyways. One thing that I really appreciate about this movie is I didn't know until after. In total, the body count for this movie is 8. We only see 2 deaths occur on screen. There was no, they didn't use any dummies for any of the dead victims and the photos depicting them.
I heard about this. This is crazy.
Which is a lot. So they had people undressed out in the open, covered in prosthetics to get these photos of, like, dead people from a serial killer or Buffalo Bill. And I just, like, because I remember seeing that first set of photos when they're doing the autopsy. And I was like, whoa, this is, like, a little too real. And it's just, like, the fact that there's, because, you know, when you're an actor, you usually have either, like, a dummy portraying your dead body so they can be morphed and shaped into different ways. But there was just something so, like, weird looking at those photos being like, I think that actress is dead. Like, that's a real person. And that was, like, the only specific time where I was, like, kind of really, like, unsettled by it. The scene where they are at the autopsy didn't really feel unsettled by that with, like, the body on the table. Although I was very weirded out because I kind of had this weird sensation where I was like, I have to put something under my nose. Yeah. I don't want to smell anything. And I was like, why are they leaving me out of this? Because I can just, like,
pass the smelling salts, bitch. I don't want to do this.
I pictured them being strawberry scented.
I honestly was just thinking, like, generic, like,
menthol.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like Vicks Vapor Rub.
Oh, God, that shit.
It will block your nose. Mm-hmm. So, or unblock it, depending on the circumstance.
True.
That was a part that I just, like, really loved about this movie. What, and for the horror aspect of it, was the fact that there was no dummies.
I also read that there were actors that they just, like, submerged in water for, like, several hours at a time to get, like, a certain look to their skin to photograph because they wanted all of the photographs to be real.
Could you imagine having to be that actor just sitting in a bathtub for, like, 5 hours?
Honestly, though, like, if you're going to cut me a fucking paycheck to sit in a bathtub for 5 hours,
true, I'll bitch, do it, but it better be warm.
Play me an audiobook.
Oh, the dream. So let's talk about the success of this movie a little bit.
Absolutely.
So I didn't look at what the actual budget was, but within the first week of the movie being released, it regained all of its budget, which is crazy. Well, it depends. I was thinking, like, it's not unlikely for a lot of movies to do that. But I think of, like, in the scale of, like, a Marvel movie where they're spending $200 million, that takes them, like, 3 weeks to get back, 4.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes longer. To get it back in a week. And it was also the first movie widely available on home video at the time to win Best Picture for Academy Awards.
Interesting.
And it's so crazy that, like, this thriller horror movie had that recognition. And it's one of the few films where the top 4 categories was won all by one mm-hmm. film. So they won Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, and I can't remember what the 4th one is now. And I
Director?
Don't. Yeah, because that's usually one of the top.
Yeah.
And I think only, like, a couple movies have ever been able to do that. Don't know what those other ones are, because guess what? Didn't look into it. In this movie, they used a lot of references from the FBI. They're FBI behavioral science unit assisted in making the movie, which really helped, I think, with actual, like,
authenticity.
Yes, and, like, undercover things and talks and whatever. But then they were so impressed with the movie that they used scenes of it in training sessions, and also, like, were hoping that this movie would help a lot of, like, female officers become FBI agents and want to be, because they had such great depictions of women. And especially with, they used the scene where Catherine, who is the one who's in the hole, who's played by Brooke Smith, which we had a full conversation about that, is begging to see her mom, in that when under a lot of psychological stress, a lot of people revert back to being a child, and that's why they ask for their parents and to see them. And that is, like, one of the scenes that they use to be like, you can see a lot of scenarios of, like, people in distress being, like, acting like children, because that's what they do when they were scared most, is when they were children. So I think it's really cool that they used it for a little bit.
Yeah, no kidding.
And, like, that this widely successful movie helped people, like, go into a new career.
Yeah.
And then Entertainment Weekly named it one of the top four movies of all time.
Amazing.
Anyways, those are kind of, like, the...
the broad strokes of success.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about the opposite of success?
Hate.
The real elephant in the 2022 room. The transphobia of it all.
Right.
So I'm going to take us on a journey. We're just going to have to go with it.
Before we get into it, one thing. Yeah. So I just read a book called Detransition Baby by Tori Peters, I believe.
Okay.
And it is about trans characters and trans representation in 2010s, 2011 to now. And they brought up Silence of the Lambs in that movie as being one of the only kind of trans representations in popular media at the time. And I was like, interesting, I just watched the movie.
Also, it was kind of unfortunate.
Yeah.
So there's, like, some pretty blatant themes in this movie that one in 2022 would call transphobic. But the interesting thing is, there has been outrage about this movie since it premiered, and the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, otherwise known as GLAAD, actually protested the movie in 1991, but it wasn't about transphobia. It was about homophobia.
Interesting.
So one of the GLAAD leaders was quoted as saying, "The killer in the movie is a walking, talking gay stereotype. He has a poodle named Precious. He sews. He wears a nipple ring. He has an affected feminine voice. And he cross-dresses. He completely promotes homophobia." So in a first attempt at quieting any controversy, Orion loaned prints of the film to AIDS fundraisers to help raise money. Did not have the desired effect. And at first, Jonathan Demme, the director, he was well-intentioned, but he was, I think, just a little confused.
Right.
He was quoted as saying, "We knew it was tremendously important to not have Buffalo Bill misinterpreted by the audience as being homosexual. That would be a complete betrayal of the themes of the movie and a disservice to gay people." He described the killer as someone who is so completely, completely horrified by who he is that his desperation to become someone completely other is manifested in his ill-guided attempts at transvestism and behaviors and mannerisms that can be misinterpreted as gay. They do say in the movie that Buffalo Bill is not truly transgender, though, but that he is creating sort of a far-off identity that he can escape to. And I think by removing him from the true transgender community, I think they believed, like, oh, we've done our job.
Right.
But I think what Jonathan Demme, as, like, a narrow-sighted, straight white man in 1991, kind of couldn't piece together at that time was that when you're watching a movie about a guy who's cutting off women's skin to make himself a real-life costume of female flesh, you're not really giving any benefit of the doubt. And you're not thinking too hard about the intention or the nuance, particularly in 1991, amid tons of anti-LGBTQ violence.
During the AIDS crisis.
Yes.
During,
and yes. When there's no other representation of transgender or queer people. I think this was a learning curve, though, and a sobering moment for Demme, who had long considered himself a champion of marginalized people and unconventional artists in feature films and documentaries. He clearly took the criticism personally and immediately bet all of his Oscar success on a movie about a gay lawyer with AIDS called Philadelphia. It's a very famous movie. It's got Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington. The movie was a considerable professional risk for him and a financial risk for TriStar, but it went on to become a box office success immediately. In following years, people would go on to talk about Philadelphia as this sort of apology for Silence of the Lambs, but both Demme and his producer maintained that those two movies had nothing to do with each other. The producer was quoted as saying, "We had wanted to make a movie in which AIDS was a major character before we ever filmed Silence of the Lambs. And as late as 2014, Demme still maintained that he wanted to make the movie, quote, because so many of my loved ones were getting sick and dying from AIDS. In later years, he also seemed to understand why activists were so upset by Silence of the Lambs. Buffalo Bill isn't gay, he was quoted as saying, and this is my directorial failing in making Silence of the Lambs, that I did not find ways to emphasize the fact that he was not gay. He explained further that one of the people who was an inspiration for his film Philadelphia said, "You can't imagine what it's like to be a 12-year-old gay kid, and you go to the movies all the time, and whenever you see a gay character, they're either a ridiculous comic relief caricature or a demented killer. It's very hard growing up gay and being exposed to all of these stereotypes." And that registered with me in a big way, he said. It's now become a part of the dialogue on stereotypical portrayals of gays in movies. He internalized that in a way where he, I think, was proud of his own internal like takeaway from that, and he knew that he learned and that he moved on from that. And I think that this sort of existing in a capsule was not a failing in his mind. He was mm-hmm. like, this serves as a learning tool for the future. And just as a note, in the book, which was written in 1988, they specify various times that Buffalo Bill is actually not trans. And when Clarice starts investigating and asking transgender clinics about him, the people working at the clinics are worried that the whole Buffalo Bill story will increase the stigma towards the trans community. And therefore, they state several times throughout the book that the people who seek help at these clinics are completely normal people. Fairly mm-hmm. progressive for 1988.
Yeah.
So as a whole, it's one of those things where at the time, though there were groups of people who were certainly aware of why this was dangerous, as a whole in society, I don't think people had the awareness that we have now about what
of course, yeah.
this would do.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like it was productive learning curve for someone rather than like Eli Roth,
mm-hmm.
who gets condemned for making a movie that is culturally insensitive and just immediately is like, well, fuck all of you then.
Right. I think also the problem that we have right now is that everybody jumps the gun to immediately cancel someone because cancel culture is so prevalent in what we have now where a lot of people don't take the time to teach. It's immediately like you do something wrong and blame the person, but also they don't use it as a teaching moment.
We have a lot of bad faith assumptions.
Yes. You know, there was people who were like, hey, this is the reason why. Let's sit down, talk about this. Here's how you could, I mean, like making another movie as an apology, it's a lot.
He has stated several times, like, that is not what that was. It just kind of happened to coincide that those mm-hmm. movies kind of happened around the same time.
I'd be very interested to see if I'm sure somebody has over time posted on Reddit who is a part of that community.
I watched a video of a guy who in the last 5 years, a trans man who was talking about how he did not find the movie offensive just because it was of a certain time. Mm-hmm. And that though it clearly contributed to stigmatizing media at the time, that it was progressive in the sense that they did try to say, this person is not part of that community. Mm-hmm. This is a completely different thing. Unfortunately, they still put him in women's clothing and
right.
kind of mimics
and skin.
That. Yeah.
So, yeah, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that I can speak to, but also all good information.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about it because mm-hmm. I know that that is something that gets brought up a lot. And it's good to know.
It is an important part of the story also.
For sure. And it's important to know the facts about that. I think in present day, when people are criticized for certain things, the reaction to that is often sort of defiant or feels very optics based, where you're sort of like, I feel like what you're doing isn't actually because you've learned anything from this. It's because you're being navigated by a PR team. Jonathan Demme's career, he has passed, a kind of lends to the fact that he actually did continuously learn throughout mm-hmm. his life and his career what it meant to represent marginalized groups.
Says a lot more than a lot of other people nowadays.
Seriously. Anyway, what other facts you got?
I feel like I don't have that many more.
One thing that I found interesting was that just the amount of other people who were meant to be cast in this movie. Jonathan Demme really, really wanted Michelle Pfeiffer for mm-hmm. Clarice because he had just done Married to the Mob, which she was in. Jodie Foster was straight off of her first Oscar win and really fought for this. And her team was sort of like, why?
Yeah.
Like, you just are off this huge win. Why are you fighting for a role?
Mm-hmm.
And I think she just kind of saw the writing on the wall. And she said, it was the first time I've ever seen something where I was a woman who got to save another woman. And I think that's kind of a beautiful thing. And I also don't think that this role would have been played well. Meg Ryan was also an option, which I think would have been not good.
Yeah, not a fan. Michelle Pfeiffer would have been fine, but I feel like she wouldn't. It would have been much.
She's too beautiful.
Yeah. I'm also thinking of her, like, in Mother, and that's where that character I would put slightly into this.
Mm. I just
think, that tone.
Yeah. And I think Jodie Foster is very clearly a woman who became an actress so that she could act. She did not become an actress because she wanted to be famous or because she was a model who was beautiful. Like, she is an actress. Michelle Pfeiffer is also an actress, but she is stopping traffic beautiful, and I think that that would have been distracting. And the sort of subtlety of Jodie Foster's beauty, because she's still a beautiful woman, lends really well to Clarice Starling.
One thing, however, even though you're saying she is an actress, part of the deal for Jodie Foster to do this movie was that Orion Pictures would allow her to direct a movie.
Oh.
And she got to direct Little Man Tate in 1991. She just wants to dip her toes in other areas. This was a good movie. Let me direct one.
I think she's gone on to direct quite a few things, actually.
I don't think I've seen any of her stuff she's directed. I wouldn't actively seek it out.
Right. Oh, I just had a note that said, this woman is not a size 14.
Right. Yes, now I know what you're talking about. But
even if she was, it's like, okay. But I love how they make such an emphasis about how he goes after fat, big women. And she's truly so standard.
Yes. She is a normal human.
Yes.
I was gonna say, that's kind of all I have for this.
We can't even stay much longer because we are about to go watch the movie that we're gonna record next. And it's at 7:50. Closing thoughts. I love this movie. I will always be a huge fan of this movie.
Quick question. Have you seen any of the other iterations?
I've seen all of them.
Yeah. And did you watch Hannibal?
Yes.
You did? Did you like it? Was it?
I
feel it's very tonally different.
It is. I found it was very, it pushed a lot of boundaries for a
television show.
For a network show, for sure. It was fine. I did like it at the time. I was pretty invested in it. But the characters are very different. But yeah, I wouldn't probably revisit it. But I did like it while it was on.
What would you think if they did do a reboot of this movie?
It's unnecessary.
I agree. It's too soon.
Well, it's not even just that. It's like, who cares?
Well, it's also like...
We also have another iteration of it. We've had other Hannibals. Like, it doesn't just stop. That's
true. The 2001 version.
Yeah, and there was one before.
I did not know that.
Yes.
It's also one of those things where it's like, how are you going to redo a movie that won a Full House sweep?
If you respect yourself at all.
Right. Don't touch it.
Yeah. You want to rate it?
Yeah.
Scary.
2.
I'm going to go with 4. I find it very unsettling at parts.
Well.
Oh, fuck. 2. Unsettling.
I feel like there's some moments like it's scenario based again.
Mm-hmm.
Being in the bottom of that well, terrifying. And then trying to get that yippy dog down there, too? Terrifying.
When I realized he was not wearing a wig, but in fact was just wearing someone's scalp, horrifying.
Like I said, he said lace front? No, scalp front.
Absolutely.
Unsettling. You said 4.
I did.
I'm going to give it like a 4 or 5 story.
10 out of 10.
I'm going to say an 8.
Okay.
I do wish that the ending was just something a little bit different, like the very, very end. It left me wanting more.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to give it an 8. That's it.
Is it a paper cut?
Oh.
Or is it a bloody massacre? It's hard to rate because this is not a very standard horror film, but because I love this movie so much, I'm just going to give it a bloody massacre. I really love it.
I'm like just under.
Okay.
It's a massacre for sure.
For sure.
But is it bloody? No. It's like one of those PG ones where you're like, where's the blood?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's dead.
I feel like there's things to talk about for days in this movie, and I feel like I somehow missed 9,000 things. However, we've done what we did here today.
Yeah.
And we're going to be back in 2 weeks to do it all again. It's a good one.
Well, we don't know yet.
It's an exciting one at the very least.
Yeah.
You know where to find us. We are on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at Podcasticker. You can leave us an email at thebloodypodcasticker@gmail.com. Why do we both have our hands on top of our heads? And
it was a marathon running this episode.
For real. You can leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Until next time.
May the silence be broken.
Oh.
I know, it's so bad.